Get ready. Get comfy for the next Nonprofit Insider Podcast episode.
All right, everyone, it's the year 2025. You knew, listen, you already remember like a year ago, I said I'm going to start doing guests, and I have not slowed down since. And this is a guest where I might need to start this episode with an apology to today's guest. We got Jen Tudor here. I connected with her way back when, said I was going to get her on the podcast. Life just kind of throws and comes at you. So I'm going to introduce her here in 1 second. But before we hop to it, be sure to like and subscribe. Go to the podcast. If you listen on Apple, if you're listening on the Spotify, whatever you're doing, go ahead and take a listen to the episode. Like, share it. You know the drill. But most importantly, be sure to rate it. It's an opportunity for you to kind of share your insights. Say, hey, I love what Swim is doing. I love the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. And you can go ahead and do that. Especially, I love when people write and type in some really cool stuff. So that's always really good. Okay, look, let's not waste any time. I want to get into today's guest. Because when you have people in the finance space, we know how important money is in a nonprofit space. But when you're able to get a director of development, you're able to get that finance lead, you're able to get that key person in an organization like we have on today's guest, you got to bring them on to the episode. So we have Jen Tudor, Director of Development of Conserving Carolina. There's so many amazing things I can say about you, Jen. Let me just start with this. How are you doing? How are you feeling? How are things today?
Thanks so much, Swim. I'm so honored to be here. And no worries. Life absolutely gets in the way of lots of things. But I'm so honored to be here. I definitely have a little bit of that imposter syndrome that so many people can relate to. So I really appreciate all your accolades and all your kindness. And I'm happy to be here as a fellow Warren Wilson College alumni and AmeriCorps service member. So I'm really, I think that's really cool that we share those things. So thank you for having me.
Well, you know, and I think that's honestly a great start. So a lot of people may not know, if you're listening to this podcast, I talk about it a fair amount. I went to Warren Wilson College. That's in Asheville, North Carolina. Asheville was in the news quite a bit last fall. And so I want to really start with that, Jen, because you've been with Conserving Carolina. We'll talk more about Conserving Carolina, but you've been with them for about 12 years, maybe even 13 years right now. And you all have been, you focus on land protection in the Southeast. And while I'm eager to hear about the work and the journey you've done within the organization, I know Western North Carolina is still recovering from Hurricane Helene. I got a good friend, shout out to my friend Nicole. She gives me all types of updates of what's happening because she's still in the Asheville area. You're in the Asheville area. You know, how are you? What's the situation? What's the current state of the community for that greater Asheville, Hendersonville, Weaverville area?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning it. Thank you for recognizing it. It's interesting. It's you know, if you've ever been through a natural disaster, there's the initial shock, there's the initial taking care of your own, making sure you're okay, making sure your neighbors are okay, all of that. And then there's the next phase of, oh, wow, what's going on with the rest of the community? And then there's the recovery phase. And I think we're in the recovery phase for sure. There's some places that have been somewhat cleaned up, and you'll be driving to work or driving past a neighborhood and then, wow, there's a landslide that still hasn't been taken care of. Or you go past the River Arts District and you see, wow, there's still a lot of damage there. So it's a strange time to be in, but I think we're doing okay. I'm so impressed by the Asheville community, the resilience, the community coming together, the goodwill. Everybody's still trying to help each other out. So I think that's where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into some more aspects of Conserving Carolina, because I can imagine to one degree or another, you're at the forefront of a lot of conversations and you're probably hearing from a lot of people in the community. But I think our audience wants to first we want to kind of learn a little bit more about you. And so, like I said, we first connected, I think it was last summer, maybe May of 2024 or something like that. But I relocated. Kids are messing around. I got my son. He's somewhere ripping and running around in this house right now. So, and I'd love to learn a little bit more about your background and fundraising. But first, tell me a little about yourself. How did you begin your nonprofit career? How was the journey that you took leading up today? You said you were in AmeriCorps. Actually, I think I forgot that you were in AmeriCorps too. Is that how it started? How did it go?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really grateful to the path that has brought me here to my career today. I think it's a little bit less and less common to have sort of the direct line that I did. I chose to go to Warren Wilson College in Asheville because it's a small work college. I wanted to go somewhere where I felt like I could really be a part of a community and not just a number in a classroom. And I loved the work aspect of it. And I also loved the community service aspect. That's a requirement of all the students is to do community service and work on campus. And that really attracted me. So I think that the Warren Wilson environment really set me up perfectly for the nonprofit world. A lot of the same values carry through. But essentially, how I ended up in my role is I was at school and there was a career fair, and I ran into a fellow former classmate who was an AmeriCorps member with
Okay.
AmeriCorps Project Conserve. And she told me all about this great AmeriCorps program and how it was a good way to get your foot in the door with environmental organizations. I should say I was an environmental studies major at the time, so it just kind of naturally fit. And I trusted her and her opinion. So I said, I'll check that out. And I applied and I ended up doing two service years with this AmeriCorps Project Conserve program at Conserving Carolina. And
Okay.
so I did that. I was the land protection associate helping with conservation projects. When those 2 years came up, it just happened that they were hiring a staff role as a donor database manager. That
Okay.
was essentially the role. I had never thought about fundraising as a career path, but I knew I really liked the organization. I liked the conservation cause. So I said, let me try this out. Let me see how this goes. And if I don't like it, I can move on.
Okay.
So I learned about fundraising from the very basic entry level of database management. And then the rest is history because I just ended up loving what fundraising is. And I still have a deep passion for our cause. So just over time, kind of rose in the ranks and became the director of development. So as I was saying, that's not really the traditional path these days. A lot of people jump around and try things out and move from career to career, but I guess I have the old school path.
But yeah, again, you and I, that's how we connected. So you went to Warren Wilson, I went to Warren Wilson. We were in different circles, right? We overlapped a little bit, but when you're a part of an alumni group, and I know we have a lot of people that listen to the podcast that are they went to the University of Michigan. We've got some University of New Mexico or New Mexico State. Those are some of where our big listeners come from. You all know you have an alumni group. You try to keep up with that alumni group. It's not as big as it used to be in like the 60s, 70s, 90s, early 2000s with the internet, but there's still an amazing opportunity to meet people through these collegiate networks. And the fact that you pretty much receive your first job through that network is not uncommon. I mean, that's not uncommon. There are a lot of people that are like that. So definitely encouraging folks to really network in the groups they're in, because clearly it worked for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely encourage talking to people you know. That's definitely a good way to you hear more about just the job description that you would find on a website. You hear about what is it like to actually work at that organization? What is it like to do that AmeriCorps service role or whatever it is? So, absolutely.
Right, because you have people that Jen, you have people that report to you, right?
Yes.
How many people report to you?
I have two amazing team members that report to me.
Okay, two. And not saying this is going to happen, but if one of those folks were to leave, right, and someone in your network said, "Hey, I have someone that could be good." I mean, I can be honest here. You're going to keep it open, but you're going to listen a little bit more. You're going to be like, "Oh, well, what's their deal? Tell me about them. Tell them to apply," right?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. It's a way to hear more about the person and hear if they would be a good fit for the role. So, yeah, definitely encourage people to build your network, build your relationships.
And you know, you said something that really kind of stuck with me a little bit. You said that you really never saw yourself as a fundraiser. And I want to talk about fundraising because it always seems that in the nonprofit space, that is more common. Even with some of like, you think of some of the greatest fundraisers, you know, a lot of them are, they would say, early in my career, this was not what I thought about. Because maybe it's not idealistic. Maybe it doesn't bring about the thoughts of major change. Oh, you're raising money, right? So it could feel like some people either really want to work in it, and once they're in it, they do it, or they want to really like avoid it like the plague. But that's the one thing about a nonprofit, right? You gotta have some money from an operational standpoint. So from your point of view, what are some of the biggest myths or facts about being a nonprofit fundraiser?
I think a huge myth about fundraising that is very common to hear is that fundraising is nothing but picking up the phone, calling a person you've never met, and asking for a ton of money. That's the first thing people think about. I have to ask somebody for money. And I probably don't know this person. It's going to be really awkward. It just creates this icky feeling in your mind of
Yeah,
that's
no,
what
it
fundraising is
does. For it really does for a lot of people.
about. So I think that's a big myth about fundraising. When in reality, if you're a fundraiser who's just picking up the phone and calling somebody you don't know and asking them for a ton of money, you're probably not gonna do a very good job. Because fundraising really, there's so much more that goes into it. It's all about connecting people to something they care about. So you're fielding people. There's people out there expressing interest, or you're talking to people and discovering their interest. And all you're doing is matching, hey, you like to hike, you care about trails. Let me tell you about my work. And then you introduce the cause, you build a relationship, you talk to them. And then honestly, the fundraising part after that, it becomes so easy. It becomes so natural. Like you don't even feel like you don't get an icky feeling when you're doing good fundraising. When you're doing the job well, there's no icky feeling. It's the opposite. You feel good. It's inspiring. You feel like, wow, we're partnering to do something and make change. So the other myth that I think is related to this, and I think people think that fundraising is all about taking. You're just taking something from someone else, and that's all it is. But I try to look at it differently. I really see it as more like giving people a tool to do something that they already want to do, make a difference that they want to make. In this climate, in this day and age, it's really easy to get overwhelmed and think, I can't do anything. Nothing I do matters. I don't have knowledge. I don't have power. But one opportunity for the person that has the resources, of course, is to consider making a donation to a cause that will make that difference you're looking to see in the world. If you can't build a trail by yourself, but maybe you can give $10 and be a part of that. And hey, I built this trail with my $10. So I think that's a big one for me, is that people see fundraising as just taking, but I really see it as a giving situation, giving back to the person, you know, giving them an opportunity.
I think you got it. Shoot, it's true. I hear and get a chance to talk to so many amazing fundraisers who kind of say a little bit of the same thing to a degree of like, hey, if this is something that's important to you and you have the resources and the finances, and that's not always the finances, right? Because you can still volunteer in that space. There's other things you could do in the financial space besides just giving money. But if you're able to aid in that particular respect, how valuable it can be to say, hey, like for me, I know I really love libraries. I've never done it before. But if I really did just all of a sudden say, you know what, I want to donate to a library association, I'm going to do that because that's something that I'm really passionate about and something that really kind of tickles me because of the way that I spent my time growing up in libraries. So yeah, it's an opportunity to really extend what you believe in and really fund those causes to one degree or another. Absolutely. 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 Listen, I want to take a quick pause here because we didn't even get into, we're going to get into Conserving Carolina. I want to talk about that. You've recently had some amazing credentials come your way, Jen. So listen, I'm going to take a quick pause. We're going to take a little break. You know, we got to feed the sponsors and everything like that. And then we'll come on back and we'll continue with the questions. Stay tuned, everyone. You know, we have to take a quick pause because I need you to do me a favor. Go ahead and share this with a friend in the nonprofit space. You love what Jen is giving you, and she's actually going to give you some really good insights, some more insights here in a little bit. So be sure to take a pause, just share it with a friend. Just hit the link, copy it, and share it with just one person, a coworker, a friend, a mentor, whoever the case may be. Share this with someone in the nonprofit space. They are going to love it. And if you really, really love me, my birthday's coming up, rate the podcast. Just go on to Apple, rate the podcast, give me 5 stars, write some nice words. It's an easy way for people to see the work that we're doing here, the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. You can keep supporting that as we pay all of our guests. We compensate them for their time because these nonprofit people are busy. They're doing amazing work, and I want to be able to make sure we keep doing that. All right, let's get back to the episode. All right, we're back once again. I am joined by Jen Tudor, Director of Development of Conserving Carolina. She is an amazing guest on today's show, and she's given us some really good insights. And so, listen, let me jump back into it, Jen, because I asked this question to Meredith Whitaker, the Foundation's Relation Development for UNC Chapel Hill on episode 47. She also went to Warren Wilson. No, she didn't. I met her not through Warren Wilson, but I met her in Asheville, different things. She was on episode 47, and I wanted to ask you the same question I asked her because she's in that fundraising space. You hear over and over again in the fundraising world that relationships are the key to raising money. Is that true? Are relationships that important in the nonprofit space, or is that something that... Or is that something that's said for fundraisers to kind of mask the fact that nonprofits need money to survive?
Absolutely, 100% relationships matter. You really need a relationship to open up dialogue. And it's a two-way thing. It's not just about, hey, I need to learn what this person is interested in so that I can ask them for money. It also is about steering your cause. You need to be able to hear from people what matters in the wider context of things. Are we doing activities? Are we accomplishing goals that really matter and make a difference? So without that relationship, you're not going to be able to get at the heart of those questions. Like, is this making a difference? Does this matter to people? So, you know, I think relationships serve a lot of purposes beyond just fundraising. They steer the organization. But for fundraising, they absolutely matter. Relationships build trust. You absolutely need trust before somebody's going to think that you as the organization will take their donation and apply it in the best way possible. So you need to build trust. You need to be able to just have conversations to learn about people, what they care about. The other thing is, I think that people tend to think of relationships in nonprofits as only being important to major donors, and that's not true. It is one aspect of fundraising that we need to work with major donors and build relationships, but we have a lot of other really important relationships that we need to focus on. We need to have relationships with our volunteers, with our community members, with the people that we're impacting. Whatever cause you're working towards, you're impacting somebody, and you need to have a relationship with that group to, you know, make it valuable. And then I also think there's kind of a case to be said that you're even building relationship with the people that are reading your email and the people that are looking at your social media. That's all a relationship. It's a different kind of relationship. It's not as deep, but, you know, you're opening up conversation. You're inviting them to follow you and learn about your cause. So it's also a relationship. So there's just so many levels of relationships that I think they're 100% important.
And I want, you know, I don't want to give a, I want to give a little bit of love here to the fundraisers of the nonprofit space, because it always feels like with any organization I've ever been in, the one person, sometimes even more than the CEO, that really, really knows the community is the fundraiser. They know what that other organization is doing. They know what the association is doing. They know what community, that they are so tapped in, and it feels like a lot of fundraisers have this amazing ability to really gel and blend and talk with multiple people in all types of different ways throughout the community. I can imagine, Jen, that's you. I mean, let's be honest, that's probably you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. High compliment.
Well, you know, and one of the things is, you know, you recently earned your CFRE, and that's the Certified Fundraising Executive. That's a credential. And so those that are unfamiliar with the CFRC, I think Meredith actually was one of the people I had on the show. She had that designation. Now, what does it signify? You know, why is it such a milestone for someone like you to get that certification in their field?
So the CFRE is a way to recognize that a professional is following a certain set of standards and practices. They're following a certain set of ethics. They have the knowledge needed to do the role well in a standardized method. And the why CFRE is so important is because there are not very many higher education programs focused on fundraising. So it's just a harder thing to establish. It's different than, you know, if you want to be a doctor, you go get your MD, you know, and that's what you do. But in fundraising, there's that doesn't really exist in the same way. So a CFRE certification helps kind of fill that role.
Okay. Gotcha. Something that actually, I didn't even know that, to be honest with you. And it's one of those things where you never put two and two together until someone says it. You're right. It's not like you can go to Duke University to be a fun. Maybe they do have it. I don't know. But that's not something that you generally see compared to an engineer, a veterinarian. I mean, even, let's be honest, even at Warren Wilson, you could be a ceramics major, right? There's not a fundraising degree. So that's a good point, that CFRE. Okay, I like that. Do you have to renew it like every couple of years or anything?
Yes. So it requires renewal every 3 years. And the requirements to get the CFRE, you have to take a really rigorous test. It's a standardized test. The first standardized test I took since I was at Warren Wilson. You have to prove that you've raised a certain amount of money. I think it's like $3 million or $2 million over time. And you have to have worked full time in fundraising for at least 3 years. It used to be 5 years, and they scaled that back. and you have to prove that you've had a certain amount of continuing education. So you're saying you've have the education, you've raised the money, you've been in the field, and you've taken the test to prove all these things.
Okay. That sounds, yeah, we have a, being in the volunteer space, we have a CVA, Certified Volunteer Administrator, something like that. So, okay, I totally get it. Well, listen, I want to circle back to your work with Conserving Carolina. I've been teased it long enough. And again, Hurricane Helene, it's being understated. We recently just had a course. Between the time you and I started talking, we've had an election, we had an inauguration, we've had crazy winters, we've had LA wildfires. And so it's natural that we've seen West North Carolina get lower and lower on the news cycle. But I mean, Hurricane Helene really did have a big impact on the area you're in. Can you share how the storm has affected your team's efforts and how the recovery might unfold in the upcoming months and years? And look, start with what even what you do. I didn't even really get a chance to get into that. Start with what even because Conserving Carolina is and how that Hurricane Helene has impacted you since.
Sure. So Conserving Carolina is a local conservation organization. And what that means to us is we aim to protect land, restore land, and inspire appreciation for nature. That's our mission. So we protect land in different ways. Sometimes we actually acquire land. We own some land and turn those into nature preserves. Oh, okay. Sometimes we acquire land and give it to state parks like Chimney Rock State Park or DuPont State Recreational Forest. So we're helping those parks expand or get started. We also work with private landowners to put conservation easements on their land. And we could have a whole seminar about conservation easements, but the short thing to remember about a conservation easement, it's a legal tool to say that a landowner will not develop their land. It's still theirs, they own it, but they essentially sell us or donate the right to develop that land. So now it's going to be natural land. So that is another part of our work. But a big thing that we do that I think is more interesting to the wider public is that we build trails. So we have 38 miles of trails, and we also create greenways. So we're working on two different rail trail greenways. One is the Acusta Trail. That's going to be 31 miles from Hendersonville to Brevard. And then we're working on the Saluda Grade Trail, which will be another 30 miles. And that's going from basically the North Carolina-South Carolina border down to Inman, South Carolina. So that, there's two different rail trails we're working on. So let me summarize to say we try to build trails. We try to build greenways. We try to get people outside by offering these public recreation opportunities.
And wait, I want to, I asked you like eight different questions in one. So now I'm bouncing around. I know Asheville in Western North Carolina, Appalachian area gets a lot of attention. And for a really long time, a lot of people called it almost like a climate change safe zone. This is a good area. Nothing can happen. We know that's not true. There's no such thing. But we know there can be a lot of people with a lot of money that can buy a lot of these pieces of land and really kind of hoard it, right? We know there's some people that are buying land in Hawaii and building them bunkers, right? I mean, that's just fact. And so when you have really rich people, millionaires and billionaires that are buying land, like, I mean, is that something that you all are not combating, but is that something that you run into being in Western North Carolina, that land can be kind of like, you know, it can be very precious?
I think, yes, there's definitely people who are either moving to the area or coming here to purchase land. Absolutely. What is very interesting and encouraging, I hope, is that we've also seen those same people, not all of them, but some of them, become really invested in protecting their land or protecting this area because they come here and they see, wow, this is really special. So some of our easement donors or people who have donated land to us are people who have second homes here or have, you know, or they moved here from somewhere else. But thankfully, they come and they realize how important it is and they see. And so, you know, it's kind of hopefully counterbalancing the bad actors with the people who come to love things. So yeah, it's definitely something we have to contend with. You know, but we only work with willing landowners. So, you know, we're not beating down somebody's door telling them that they have to conserve their land. We work in more of a look how amazing this is, come to us kind of model, like teach people why it's important and how they can make a difference and attract them to us.
I want to make sure people get a chance. Go to conservingcarolina.org. We're going to put that in the show notes. I'm looking at your website right now. One, it's a beautiful website. Whoever did the web design did a really good job. So you could definitely go there, learn more about them, support what they're doing, get some good education. Obviously, Jen and I have spent time in Western North Carolina, her more so than I, and she is right. Absolutely beautiful, gorgeous part of the United States, gorgeous part of North America. And so, look, like I said, I asked you like 8 million questions. How, one more time, how is it going? And what does it look like over the next like 12 months, if you had to say, post-Hurricane Helene, there might be federal government is, I know, is spending money, and they got the states, you got the governor. I think it was like you just had a new governor, and like the first day they were in the astral era or something like that. What does the future look like now that Hurricane Helene has passed, knowing the work that you all do?
Yeah, I think for us, our main focus right now is cleaning up our trails and our preserves. So we're still deep into that. All of our trails were impacted by the storm to varying degrees. Some, it was just trees down, you know, some trail tread we had to be fixed. Some were more severely impacted. We have at least one trail that has a huge landslide slash cliff now that it didn't have. And also we have some of our trails closed because roads are closed or roads are impacted. So a lot of our trails are out towards Chimney Rock, Fairview, out in that direction. And those roads are still impacted and not very accessible to the average person unless you live there. So we've closed those trails. And some of our preserves have things like landslides that we're trying to deal with. So, we're really heavily focused on that, just trying to get things cleaned up, get our trails back open. The other side of it, I think that's very interesting. During the storm, we had three different sites where we have done restoration along the French Broad River. So these are areas that were way before the storm impacted by bad farming or bad development. And the river itself was channelized or the wetlands were not natural anymore. So in these areas, we have gone in with contracted help and recreated the wetlands, repaired the river back to its natural state. And so we had three different restoration sites during the storm that actually prevented worse flooding for the areas around them. So restoration has become suddenly a really big topic and focus of ours. It's always been something we've worked on, but now more than ever, we're realizing we need to focus on restoration because it helps prevent worse storm damage. So that is definitely a change for us. I think we're figuring out how do we shift more of our resources to our restoration projects.
Really? See, now that's something, even if you don't know a lot about conserving, you can hear that and just know, oh, that's good. Right? That's good. Because when you're talking about diverting rivers or waterways, a lot of people may not truly realize the side effects or the damages that can come from doing something like that. So the fact that you just said that, I'm like, wow. I mean, the work you're doing, it's important, right? I mean, this is a real deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was very interesting that during the storm, we're doing a lot of publicity about restoration and showing how it made a difference. And it just got like so much attention, like on our social media. Our social media just blew up because people are like, whoa, this is so cool. I didn't realize this could work this way. So that's been an interesting effect of the storm.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, and that's one of those things, because I know you're going to talk about how people can support the work that you all are doing at Conserving Carolina, all that stuff. But this is something where you can't do this alone. I mean, you can't do this alone. And as much as you all are out there and you're really leading it, I can imagine you all have partnerships, maybe work with other organizations, government groups. How does that work? I think you're a 501c3, if not mistaken. Like, how does that work with a 501c3 like you in terms of partnerships with other groups or maybe even government groups?
We absolutely have all kinds of partnerships, from the partnership with local schools to do education to formalized partnerships, where we have MOUs, memorandum of understanding, saying we will do one thing if you do another thing. We have tons of partnerships, different levels. We also work in partnerships around some of our conservation projects. So a really cool one, I think, that is an example of a partnership with a land trust, which we are conservation/land trust. Is this project we did, it was back in 2017, down in Polk County, but essentially there was about 1,000 acres of a mountain. I mean, it's a mountain on its own, called Little White Oak Mountain. And the, mountain itself was owned by a developer. Thankfully, during 2007 market crash, all of that, this developer went under. So they didn't develop the mountain. Oh. Thankfully. But it came up for sale. So in 2017, it was like, it's for sale. Easily another developer could have purchased it and turned it into, you know, multi-million dollar homes, you know, on the ridge, terrible situation. So we stepped up and said, we can't let that happen. We need to protect this mountain. There's clean water, streams, there's vulnerable species. It's all forested. It's beautiful. We want to protect it. So we stepped up and said, let's do that. Let's protect it. But in the way that it turned into a partnership situation, I think, is we purchased the land, about 1,000 acres. We gave 600 acres to the Green River Game Lands. So now that's public land. We gave 300 acres to the Polk County Recreation System to create a county park, essentially. And this mountain, the public school, I think it's the middle school, is right there at the base of the mountain. So now the public school has access to a county park, nature park, right behind the school. So you have the public school, you have the Green River Game Lands. The next part of the partnership is there were about 30 acres of land that was already degraded. It was already planted into pine crop. It just wasn't natural. Okay. So we gave that 30 acres to a local workforce housing development organization. So they took those 30 acres and they built workforce housing. So we have, so I think that's just like a really cool partnership of school, public access, workforce housing, conservation, all in one project. So I think that's a really good example.
And again, if you are someone who values trails, biodiversity, clean water, I mean, let's be honest, who can't really get behind that? But if you're someone that supports that, and I give you all $100 to go to something like that, that's what I'm talking about. That's the work that fundraisers across America, across the world are really doing at some of the highest levels, trying to make sure that that mission is at the forefront. And what a great example, Jen. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm back there, I need to go visit. You gotta show me a tour.
Absolutely. I would love to take you on a tour. We can go any
Yeah. I might be there sooner than you realize. And listen, I'm gonna ask you a question here. We get to the end here. I'm gonna ask you a question. We're not gonna get in trouble. I'm gonna ask you a question here because as someone deeply involved in conservation and fundraising, what do you see as major hurdles facing groups like Conserving Carolina in today's climate? Because it's been a little rocky out here.
For sure. It's definitely a little rocky. I think two things. One, I think it's hard just finding the balance between keeping up with trends, whether that's societal trend, political trend, whatever is going on, the hot button issues, keeping up with those things, but also just like maintaining this is our mission and moving forward. It's hard balance. Like, for example, AI is a huge thing right now. Mm. So, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. AI and nonprofits and AI in the world. So it's like, yeah, we need to deal with that and figure out, you know, organizational policy around that. There's also the issue that AI has an environmental impact.
Oh, I've been hearing a lot about that.
So we're having some conversations like internally, like, oh gosh, yes. How are we going to manage that? So, you know, just trying to get ourselves through whatever the like big hot button issue is a big one. But the other thing that is hard, it can be hard for us. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's hard, is, you know, we're not an advocacy organization. We're nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful. But where it gets interesting is we have issues that are very directly tied to our cause, like climate change, mm-hmm. the climate crisis. Is imperative to our work. You know, it affects, you know, plants and animals, it affects humans, it affects us all, and we have a part to play in that. So that's an issue where we are trying to be nonpartisan, but we're not going to pretend like the climate crisis isn't real. We're not going to hide behind, you know, we're going to look at the science and we're going to be out there about the climate crisis. But we also, you know, are trying not to get too political. So that's the kind of thing that it's a fine balance.
Absolutely. You know, one of my early episodes, Jen, was when I talked about, I'm doing with Jen Tudor, Director of Development, Conserving Carolina. If you haven't had a chance, go back, listen to some of her previous episodes. Sometimes, Jen, we have people that skip ahead. And I'm like, no, you got to start from the beginning. And in one of my previous episodes, Jen, I talked about how a lot of people may not realize that there's 20, I think it was like, is it 26 or 29? I almost can't remember. There's 29 different designations for what a nonprofit is. And so the big one is people know what a 501c3 is because they can donate and they can provide money to those groups. But there's other groups like a 501c4, I think, if I'm not mistaken. What's the one I'm thinking of? Sierra? What's the one that I can never...
Sierra Club?
Sierra Club, as an example, is a 501c4. So they do endorsements of candidates and advocacy groups. They also have a 501c3 designation as well. So yeah, definitely understanding where you're coming from. Like, listen, we do have rules. In order to get this tax exemption, the IRS says, hey, you can't do this, that, and the third. And so sometimes that's a blessing, and sometimes it can, not a curse, that's not the right word, but it can kind of prevent you from doing certain things that you want to do. So yeah, just making sure that staying within the guidelines. And you all do an amazing job. Again, go to conservingcarolina.com. They have an amazing website. I need to donate some money because I'm kind of slacking.
You can become a recurring member if you think about it. Then you can. it's conservingcarolina.org.
Oh, that I
yeah. Yeah.
Rookie.
Easy, see, this easy is, to do. Easy
that's
to
a
do.
Rookie move. Yeah. Well, listen, I want to get you out of here a little bit. We taught Warren Wilson. I want to talk just Warren Wilson one more time before we got out of here, because you know I'm going to tag them a bunch. They're going to get tired of hearing our names. But tell me a little bit about your time. How was your time at Warren Wilson? How did it shape your approach to conservation? And did Warren Wilson... did it shape your approach to fundraising based off of the education you received there?
Absolutely, Warren. My time at Warren Wilson shaped who I am today, and that is seen in the way I work. Warren Wilson's all about community. It's a small community. When you're there, your friend is scrubbing the toilet, your other friend is serving pizza, and you're working with your professors day in and day out. It's just such a tight-knit community that for me, that just really stuck. And I think even today at my nonprofit that serves tens of thousands of people, I still sometimes see it as a tight-knit little community, and I'm thinking about the person that is building the trail, and I'm thinking about the volunteer who's entering volunteer hours, and you know, I'm thinking about all these people and how we all fit together. So I would say Warren Wilson's community, the community aspect, is something that's definitely shaped me. And also, Swim, you'll remember, Warren Wilson is just a beautiful place.
It is. I
around in my mountains, and you wake up in the morning and there's fog rolling over the farm and the pigs are out there. It's just beautiful. And that just sunk so deep to my core that I was like, yeah, conservation is important. I don't even need written justification. I just look around, and to me it's just intrinsically important. So I just falling in love with the place of Warren Wilson definitely impacted me to put my career in the conservation path.
You hear that, so many people, they go, I mean, it's so influential, the college you go to, and definitely Wilson's got that going on. Dang, I haven't mentioned Wilson this much on any of my podcast episodes, so they're going to really love it. Listen, I want to wrap up the interview here, and we like to always wrap up an interview with a nonprofit horror story. But before we get to that, though, That's a little teaser. Before we get to that story, how can people support the work that you're doing? If they want to support Conserving Carolina, if they want to connect with you, anything like that, how can people do that?
Sure. I recommend, please follow us on Facebook. That's our primary social media platform. We have Instagram too, but you'll get more content. You'll be able to read more on Facebook. So please follow us on Facebook. You'll be able to get some of our updates, like what land we're protecting or a new restoration project, trail updates as we open trails up. We'll post that on our Facebook. Please follow us on Facebook. And if you're willing, go to our website and sign up for our emails. That's another way to get some more information. So please sign up for our emails. Stay tuned in. If you're in Western North Carolina, if you're visiting, or if you're local, either way, you can go to our website, and we have all of our trails posted, directions, mileage, difficulty, all that stuff's on there. So you can learn about where our trails are. Please go check them out when they're open.
Okay. What? That's a good point. When they're open, I'm going to be there actually. It looks like in March. Don't tell anybody. So I'm going to message you on the side here. That's really
Yeah,
good.
please
That's
do.
really good. When you've been in the game of nonprofits as long as you have, Jen, you're going to have stories. You know, we're famous here on the Nonprofit Insider Podcast for having our hashtag nonprofit horror story. It's an opportunity to shine light on some of the real challenges in the nonprofit world because it's not all peaches and rainbows here. I mean, sometimes it can get a little bit tough. So, do you have a story that you're thinking you're going to tell?
Yes, I have one, and it's not that crazy, but I tell you, in the moment, it felt like the end of the world. So imagine this. We have an advisory board, and that's local business owners and politicians and major donors, these influential people. And we have it's during COVID, and we're doing everything online. And we're coming up to our advisory board meeting. And I'm the one who is coordinating the meeting, making sure people attend and all of that. And it's right before the meeting, it's like 15 minutes before. And my director says, "Hey, tell me a little bit about the meeting." And in my response in an email, I start typing, "Nobody's showing up. They're not following through. I don't know where everybody is. I don't know how to get them invigorated." Like, I'm just griping on this advisory board of all these important people. Well, guess what I do? I hit reply all. I reply all to said advisory council. And I was like, no. So I didn't realize it at first. And then it came through to me as like it came through in my inbox, and I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die because I'm griping about these people who are like, they're powerful people to me at the time, to me at the time. And I was just mortified. I was absolutely mortified. But the funny thing is, nobody said anything. They didn't seem to even really notice. So it just goes to show that these people, one, they either don't care or they didn't have take the time to say anything. So it just didn't really matter to them. But to me, it was the end of the world. And I have a tip for everybody. If you haven't done it yet, if you use Outlook or whatever, probably other email systems use it, but you can set your emails to delay. So after that incident, I learned how to put a 3-minute delay on my emails. So now I can check, like, oh, oops, I sent that to the wrong person or I left something off or whatever. So it's a good tip if you're worried about if you're trigger happy with the send button like me, use the delay.
That's a good tip. Two, that's a good story, honestly, because that probably doing that has a 100% hit rate. We have all done it, right? To one degree or another, we've all sometimes it's you hit reply all and you're saying stuff that maybe you shouldn't. Sometimes you make a joke you shouldn't. It could be any number of things, right? Sometimes it could be really bad and you could get fired, right? But for the most part, it's usually like it's something that's not super crazy, but you just hit that reply. I know I've done it, and it's so embarrassing. Mortifying is the exact word. So I'm glad nothing crazy happened. Everything worked out the way it needed to be. So you're not alone. And listen, if someone like the director of development of a major nonprofit in the Southeast can have that type of experience, it's okay if you have that type of experience. One more time, I'm joined, Jen Tudor, Director of Development, Conserving Carolina. You've given us some really good insights, and you've really taken us in the mind, Jen, of what it is that you do, who you are, your organization. You've really given us like the whole 360. I'm so glad you came on the show today.
Thank you so much, Flim. It was really fun to talk to you and reminisce and learn some things. And yeah, I'm a little bit starstruck. I meant to start this in the beginning because, when we were in school together, I definitely thought you were part of the popular crowd and too cool.
No.
Yes, you were very outspoken and friends with everybody, and I was a little shy, so so I'm honored to be here.
Well, hey, I'm seriously glad to have you here, and this has been so fun and just getting some really good insights. And so, yes, if you haven't had a chance, listen to previous episodes of Nonprofit Insider Podcast, because maybe this is your first time listening. You maybe wanted to hear what Jen had to say. Jen has an amazing network. Reach out to her, reach out to the organization that she does, and we'll see you all in future episodes. Jen, we hope you have a good rest of the day. Hope you have a good start to spring here soon.
Yeah, thanks so much. Take care.